The Cat Who Could Read Backwards, Disc 5.
Chapter 14. Thursday morning, Quillerin telephoned Lodge Kendall at the press room and police headquarters. He said, "I've picked up some information on Lambeth and Mount Clemens. Why don't you bring the homicide guys to lunch at the club?"
"Make it dinner. Hames and Wojcik are working nights."
"Do you think they're willing to discuss the case?"
"Oh, sure, especially Hames. He's a relaxed type. Never underestimate him, though. He's got a mind like a computer."
Quillerin said, "I'll get to the club early and snag a quiet table upstairs. Is 6 o'clock okay?"
"Make it 6:15. I won't promise, but I'll try to have them there."
Quillerin wrote 6:15 on his desk calendar and reluctantly considered the possibility of starting his day's work. He sharpened a handful of pencils, cleaned out his paperclip tray, filled his glue pot, straightened his stack of copy paper. Then he pulled out his draft of the Butchie Bolton interview and put it away again. No hurry. The photo department had not yet produced any pictures to accompany the story. Without much effort, he found similar excuses to postpone most of the other chores in his next file. He was in no mood to work. He was too busy wondering how the Daily Fluxion would react to the idea of a murderer on the staff, on the culture beat, no less. He could visualize the editorial embarrassment if the police pinned Lambreth's murder on Mount Clemens, and he could picture the other newspaper gleefully capitalizing on the scandalous news. No, it was unthinkable. Newspaper writers reported on homicide. They never indulged in it. Quillerin had liked Mount Clemens. The man was a delightful host, clever writer, unashamed egotist, cat worshipper, fearless critic, miser with electric light bulbs, sentimentalist about old houses, and an unpredictable human being. He could be curt one minute, genial the next, as he was on the night he heard the news of Lambeth's murder. The newsman looked at his calendar. There was nothing on his schedule until 6:15. 6:15. The hour the clock stopped for Earl Lambeth. 6:15? Quillerin felt a prickling sensation in his mustache. 6:15. Then Mount Clemens had an alibi. It was 6:20 that evening when the police reporter turned up with the two men from the Homicide Bureau, Hames, blandly amiable, and Wojcik, all business. Hames said, "Aren't you the fellow with the cat that can read?" "He can not only read," said Quillerin, "he can read backwards and don't laugh. I'm sending him to the FBI Academy when he grows up, and he may get your job."
"He'll do all right, too. Cats are born snoopers. Our kids have a cat that gets into everything. He'd make a good cop or a good newspaper man."
Hames scanned the menu.
"Before I order, who's paying for this meal? The Daily Fluxion or us underpaid guardians of the public welfare?"
Wojcik said to Quillerin, "Kendall tells us you want to talk about the art murders." "I've picked up a few facts. Do you want to hear them now or do you want to order first?"
"Let's hear."
"Well, it's like this. Lambeth's widow seems to have made me her confidant. And she told me a few things last night after I discovered something unusual in Mount Clemens's apartment."
"What were you doing up there?"
"Looking for the cat's toy mouse. It's an old sock filled with dried mint. He was going crazy because he couldn't find it." Hames said, "Our cat's wild for catnip, too. This isn't catnip, it's fresh mint that Mount Clemens grew in a pot on the windowsill."
"Same thing," said Hames. "Catnip's a member of the mint family."
"So what did you find that was unusual?" said Wojcik.
"A painting of a monkey that seemed to ring a bell. I called Mrs. Lambeth and she came over and identified it."
"What's with this monkey?"
"It has to do with that painting of a ballet dancer by Girotto at the Lambeth Gallery." Hames said, "We have one of those Girotto dancers at home. My wife bought it for $14.95 at Sears."
"Girotto painted a lot of dancers," said Quillerin, "and the reproductions are quite popular, but this one is unique. It's only half a painting. The canvas was ripped and the two halves sold separately. Lambeth owned the half with Girotto's signature and was hunting for the other half, which had a monkey on it. Combined and restored, they'd be worth $150,000.
Hames said, "They get ridiculous prices for art these days. Does anybody want one of these poppy seed rolls?"
Wojcik said,
"And you found the missing half?"
"In the closet. in Mount Clemens's apartment, said Quillerin.
In a closet? You were really snooping, weren't you?
Quillerin's mustache rebelled, and he smoothed it.
I was looking for the cat's... Okay, so it looks like Mount Clemens killed a man to get a picture of a dame in a short skirt. What else do you know?
Quillerin, irritated by Wojcik's brusqueness, found his spirit of cooperation flagging. He said to himself, let him dig up his own lousy clues. With a degree of reluctance, he told the detective, Mount Clemens had apparently been making eyes at Mrs. Lambreth.
Did she tell you that?
Quillerin nodded.
Women always say that. Was she interested in Mount Clemens?
Quillerin shook his head.
Foiled, said the jovial Hames. So the villain went home and committed harakiri in his backyard, after which he swallowed the knife to conceal the evidence of suicide and throw suspicion on the poor widow. Will someone please pass the butter?
Wojcik threw his partner an impatient scowl.
However, said Quillerin coolly, I have an alibi for Mount Clemens.
He paused and waited for the reaction.
Kendall was all eyes and ears. Wojcik was twiddling a spoon. Hames was buttering another roll.
Quillerin proceeded. Lambreth was murdered at 6:15, according to the electric desk clock that stopped at that hour, but Mount Clemens was on the 3 o'clock plane to New York. I bought his ticket for him.
You bought his ticket? Said Hames. But do you know whether he used it? Perhaps he changed his reservation and went on the 7 o'clock plane after killing Lambreth at 6:15.
Funny thing about that clock stopping at 6:15, it wasn't damaged. It was merely unplugged from the wall socket. It appears that the murderer went to some pains to stage signs of a violent shindy, place the clock on the floor and disconnect the juice, thus pinpointing the hour of the crime. Had the struggle been genuine and had the clock been knocked to the floor accidentally in the heat of battle, it would probably have been damaged, and if it had not been damaged, it would have continued to run unless its fall had yanked the plug from the wall socket. However, considering the position of the desk and the location of the wall socket and the spot where the clock was found, it is doubtful whether such a fall could have disconnected the plug accidentally. So, it appears that the murderer made a special effort to register the hour of the murder by means of the clock for the purpose of establishing an alibi, after which he took a later flight. All of this assuming that your art critic with a 3 o'clock plane ticket was actually the killer.
Wojcik said,
We'll check the airline.
After the detectives had left, Quillerin had another cup of coffee with Lodge Kendall and said,
Did you say Hames had a mind like a computer? It's more like a cement mixer.
Kendall said,
I think he's right. I'll bet Mount Clemens had you pick up his plane ticket for the express purpose of emphasizing that 3 o'clock departure. Then he took a later flight. Lambreth would have no qualms about letting him in the gallery after hours, and Mount Clemens probably took the man completely by surprise.
With only one hand?
He was tall. He came up behind Lambreth, got a stranglehold with his right arm, and plunged the chisel in Lambreth's exposed throat with his good left hand. Then he roughed up the office, disconnected the clock, damaged some art to leave a false clue, and took a later plane.
Quillerin shook his head.
I can't picture Mount Clemens on the other end of that chisel.
Got a better theory?
I'm playing with one. It hasn't gelled yet, but it might explain all three deaths.
What's in that package?
The tapes the police impounded. There's nothing on them, just an art review. Are they any good to you?
I'll give them to Arch, Quillerin said.
And maybe I'll write some kind of memorial piece to go with Mount Clemens's last column.
Careful how you phrase it. You might be writing a memorial to a murderer, Kendall said.
Quillerin's mustache made a stubborn stand. He said,
I have a hunch you'll find Mount Clemens was on that 3 o'clock plane.
When Quillerin arrived home with the tape reels under his arm, it was nearing 8 o'clock, and Coco met him at the door with an impatient clamor. Coco was not in favor of Quillerin's casual meal schedule.
If you'd learned to talk, I wouldn't have to hang around the press club so much, the newsman explained, and you'd get your dinner on time.
Coco passed one paw over his right ear and gave his left shoulder blade 2 short licks with his tongue. Quillerin studied the signals thoughtfully. I guess you can talk all right. I'm just not bright enough to read you. After dinner, Cat and Man went upstairs to the dictating machine on the critic's desk, and Quillerin slipped a reel on the spindle. The sharp voice of the late George Bonnefield Mount Clemens, made more nasal by the quality of the equipment, filled the room.
For publication Sunday, March 8. Serious collectors of contemporary art are secretly acquiring all available works by the celebrated Italian painter Scrano, it was learned this week. For reasons of ill health, the artist, for 20 years a recluse in the Umbrian hills, is no longer able to produce the paintings that have earned him the accolade of modern master. Scrano's final works are now en route to the United States, according to his New York agent, and prices may be expected to soar. In my own modest collection, I have a small Scrano painted in 1958, and I have been offered 20 times its original cost. Needless to say, I would not part with it.
There was a pause in the dictation, while a few inches of tape unwound thoughtfully. Then the ringing voice dropped to a more casual tone. Correction. Editor, delete the last 2 sentences. There was another pause, then. Scrano's work is handled locally by the Lambeth Gallery, which will reopen soon, it has been announced. The gallery closed following the tragedy of February 25, and the art world mourns, correction, the local art world mourns, the passing of a respected and influential figure. The quality of Scrano's work has not wavered, despite age and illness. He combines the technique of an old master, the hubris of youth, the insight of a sage, the expressiveness. Coco sat on the desk, regarding the spinning tape with fascination and purring a rich, throaty accompaniment.
"Recognize your old roommate?" asked Quillerin with a note of sadness. He himself was affected by the sound of Mount Clemens's last words, and he smoothed his mustache pensively. As the tape reel rewound at high speed, Coco lowered his head and fervently rubbed his jaw against the edge of the machine.
Quillerin said, "Who killed him, Coco? You're supposed to be able to sense things." The cat sat tall on the desk with 4 legs close to his body and stared at Quillerin with wide eyes. The blue disappeared, and there were large black voids. He swayed slightly.
"Go ahead, talk. You must know who killed him."
Coco closed his eyes and uttered a tentative squeak.
"You must have seen it happen. Tuesday night, out the back window. Cats can see in the dark, can't they?"
The cat's ears waggled, one forward and one back, and he jumped to the floor. Quillerin watched while he prowled about the room, aimlessly at first, looking under a chair here and a cabinet there, peering into the cold black fireplace, touching an electric cord with a wary paw. Then he thrust his head forward and down. He began to zigzag down the long hall to the kitchen, and Quillerin followed. At the bedroom door, Coco gave a perfunctory sniff. At the threshold of the kitchen, he stopped and murmured something in his throat. Then he backtracked down the long hall to the tapestry that covered much of the wall space opposite the bedroom door. Woven into the tapestry was the scene of a royal hunting party with horses, falcons, dogs, and small game. Dim light and the fading of age made the figures almost indistinguishable, but Coco showed pronounced interest in the rabbits and wildfowl that filled one corner of the design. Was it true, Quillerin wondered, that cats could sense the content of a picture? Coco touched it experimentally with his paw. He reared on his hind legs and waved his head from side to side like a cobra. Then, dropping to all fours, he sniffed the lower edge of the tapestry where it grazed the floor.
Quillerin said, "Is there something behind that thing?"
He lifted one corner of the heavy hanging and saw nothing but plain wall. Yet Coco gave a joyous cry. Quillerin raised the corner higher, and the cat pushed his way behind the tapestry, proclaiming his delight in positive tones. "Wait a minute." Quillerin went for the flashlight and shone a wedge of light between tapestry and wall. It revealed the edge of a door frame, and that was where Coco was rubbing and sniffing and voicing his excitement. Quillerin followed, burrowing with some difficulty between the heavy textile and the wall until he came to the bolted door. The catch slid open easily, and the door swung out over a narrow stairway. It made a sharp turn and descended to the floor below, where it was closed off by a second door. At one time this would have been the servants' stairs. There was a light switch, but no light bulb responded. Quillen was not surprised. He descended with the aid of the flashlight, thoughtfully. If this led to the rear apartment, which the critic had claimed to use for storage, there was no telling what treasures might be found. Coco had already scampered to the bottom and was waiting impatiently. Quillerin picked him up and opened the door. He found himself in a large, old-fashioned kitchen, with drawn window shades and the aroma of disuse. Yet the room was comfortably warm. It was more studio than kitchen. There was an easel, a table, a chair, and, against one wall, a cot. Many unframed canvases stood on the floor face to the wall. One door led to the patio, another toward the front of the house opened into a dining room. Quillerin ran the flashlight over a marble fireplace and an ornate built-in sideboard, otherwise the room was bare. Coco wriggled to get free, but there was dust everywhere, and Quillerin kept a tight hold on the cat while he turned his attention back to the kitchen. One painting stood on the sink counter, propped against the cupboards above. It was a portrait of a steely blue robot against a rusty red background, disturbingly real and signed by the artist, O. Narks. There was a three-dimensional quality in the work, and the robot itself had the glint and texture of actual metal. It was covered with dust. Quillerin had heard it said that old houses manufacture their own dust. Alongside the back door, a kitchen table, well crusted with dried paint of many colors, held a jar of brushes, a palette knife, and some twisted tubes. The easel stood near the window, and on it was another square-headed mechanical man in a menacing pose. The painting was unfinished, and a brushful of white paint splashed across the canvas had disfigured it. Coco squirmed and squealed and made himself a troublesome armful, and Quillerin said, "Let's get upstairs. There's nothing down here but dirt." At the top, after bolting the door and groping his way out from under the tapestry, Quillerin said, "False alarm, Coco. You're losing your knack. There were no clues down there." Cao Ko Kung gave him a withering look, then turned his back and licked himself extensively. Chapter 15. Friday morning, Quillerin sat at his typewriter and stared at the row of keys that spelled QWERTYUYUP. He hated that word, QWERTYUYUP. It meant that he was stymied, that he should be writing brilliant copy, and that he hadn't an idea in his head. It was 3 days since he had found the body of Mount Clemens sprawled in the patio. It was 4 days since Nino had fallen to his death. It was 9 days since the murder of Earl Lambreth. Quillerin's mustache was twitching and sending him signals. It kept suggesting that the three deaths were connected. One person had killed the art dealer, pushed Nino off the scaffolding, and knifed Mount Clemens. And yet, to spoil his argument, there was the possibility that Mount Clemens had committed the first murder. The telephone on his desk rang 3 times before it won his attention. Lodge Kendall was on the line, saying, "Thought you'd like to know what homicide found out at the airline." "Huh? Oh, yes, what did they find out?" "The alibi holds. The passenger list indicates Mount Clemens was on that afternoon flight." "Did it depart on time?" "Right on schedule." "Did you know the airline puts passenger lists on microfilm and keeps them for 3 years? "No. I mean, yes. That is, thanks for filling me in." So Mount Clemens had an alibi, and Quillerin had some support for his new theory. Only one person, he told himself, had a motive in all three crimes and the strength to plunge a blade into a man and the opportunity to push Nino to his death. Only Butchie Bolton. And yet it was all too neat, too pat. Quillerin was reluctant to trust his suspicions. He went back to his typewriter. He looked at the blank sheet of paper waiting expectantly. He looked at the 10 green typewriter keys. QWERTYUYUP. Butchie, he was aware, had a serious grudge against Earl Lambeth. She thought he had cheated her out of a lucrative commission and considerable prestige. Furthermore, Lambeth was encouraging his wife to drop Butchie. Grievances like these could build up in the imagination of a woman who had a personality problem and was given to violent fits of temper. With Lambeth out of the way, she might reason, Zoe would again be her best friend as in the old days. But there was another obstacle in Butchie's way. Zoe was showing inordinate interest in Nino. If Nino were to meet with a fatal accident, Zoe might have more time and enthusiasm for her girlhood friend. Quillerin whistled through his mustache as he remembered another fact. It had been Butchie's idea, according to Mrs. Bookwalter, to put that piece of junk sculpture on the scaffolding. After Nino's death, Butchie faced other complications. Mount Clemens was posing a threat to Zoe's happiness and her career, and Butchie, fiercely protective, might see a chance to eliminate this distressing dilemma. QWERTY Yui up. "Do you always look so puzzled when you write?" asked a soft voice. Startled, Quillerin could only splutter. He jumped to his feet. Zoe said, "I'm sorry. I shouldn't have come to your office without telephoning first, but I was downtown having my hair done, and I took a chance on finding you here. The girl at the desk said I could walk right in. Am I interrupting something important?"
"Not at all," Quillerin said. "Glad you dropped in. Let's go to lunch."
Zoe was looking strikingly handsome. He pictured himself ushering her into the press club, basking in curious stares, answering questions later. But Zoe said, "Not today, thanks. I have another appointment. I'd just like to talk to you for a few minutes." Quillerin found a chair for her, and she pulled it close to his. In a low voice, she said, "There's something I should tell you, something that's been on my conscience, but it isn't easy to discuss."
"Will it help the investigation?"
"I don't know, really." She glanced around the room. "Is it all right to talk here?"
"Perfectly safe," Quillerin said.
"The music critic has his hearing aid turned off, and the man at the next desk has been in a fog for 2 weeks. He's writing a series on income tax."
Zoe smiled meagerly and said, "You asked me how Mount Clemens could afford to buy his art treasures, and I evaded the question. But I've decided that you should be told, because indirectly it reflects on this newspaper."
"In what way?"
"Mount Clemens was taking the profits from the Lambeth Gallery."
"You mean your husband paid him off?"
"No. Mount Clemens owned the Lambeth Gallery."
"He owned it?"
Zoe nodded. "Earl was only an employee." Quillerin puffed through his mustache.
"What a setup.
Mount Clemens could write free plugs for his own merchandise and blast the competition, and the Flux paid him to do it."
"Why didn't you tell me this before?"
Zoe's hands fluttered. "I was ashamed of Earl's connection in the deal. I guess I hoped the secret would die with him."
"Did your husband discuss gallery business at home?"
"Not until recently. I had no idea of Mount Clemens's connection with the gallery until a few weeks ago, when Earl and I had the showdown over Mount Clemens. It was then he told me what kind of operator Mount Clemens really was. It came as a complete shock."
"That I can believe."
"I was even more appalled at Earl's involvement. After that, he began to tell me more about the gallery operation. He had been under a terrible strain, and he was overworked. Well paid, but overworked. Mount Clemens wouldn't hire any help, or didn't dare. Earl did everything. Besides meeting the public and coping with artists, he made the picture frames and kept the books. My husband used to work for an accounting firm."
"Yes, I'd heard that," said Quillerin.
"Earl had to take care of all the government red tape and juggle the figures on the tax returns."
"Juggle them, did you say?"
Zoe smiled bitterly.
"You don't suppose a man like Mount Clemens reported all his income, do you?"
"What did your husband think about that bit of snookery?"
"He said it was Mount Clemens's funeral, not his. Earl merely did what he was told, and he wasn't liable."
Zoe bit her lip.
"But my husband kept a complete record of actual sales."
"You mean he kept two sets of books?"
"Yes, for his own information." Quillerin said. Was he intending to use that information?
Earl was getting to the end of his rope. Something had to be done, some change in the arrangement. And then there was this unpleasantness about me. That's when Earl confronted Mount Clemens with some demands.
Did you hear their discussion?
No, but Earl told me about it. He threatened Mount Clemens if he didn't leave me alone.
Quillerin said, I don't imagine our late art critic would scare very easily.
Oh, yes, he was scared, said Zoe. He knew my husband wasn't joking. Earl threatened to tip off the Internal Revenue people. He had the records that would prove fraud. He would even get a commission from the government for informing.
Quillerin leaned back in his chair.
Wow, he said softly.
That would have blown the whole mess wide open.
The ownership of the gallery would have been exposed, and I'm afraid the Daily Fluxion would have looked rather bad.
That's putting it mildly. The other newspaper would really make hay out of a thing like that.
And Mount Clemens would have to stand trial, Earl said. It would mean a jail term for fraud.
It would have been the end of Mount Clemens, here or anywhere else. They stared at each other in silence, and then Quillerin said, He was a complex character.
Yes, Zoe murmured.
Did he really know art?
He had a brilliant knowledge, and in spite of his crooked streak, there was no misrepresentation in his column. Whatever he praised at the Lambeth Gallery was praiseworthy. The stripe paintings, the graphics, Nino's junk sculpture.
What about Scrano?
His concept is obscene, but the technique is flawless. His work has a classic beauty.
All I see is a flock of triangles.
Ah, but the proportions, the design, the depth and mystery in a flat composition of geometrics. Superb, almost too good to be true.
Quillerin challenged her boldly. What about your own painting? Is it as good as Mount Clemens said?
No, but it will be. The dirty colors I used expressed my inner turmoil, and that's all over now.
Zoe showed Quillerin a cold-blooded little smile.
I don't know who killed Mount Clemens, but it's the best thing that could have happened.
Venom darted from her eyes.
I don't think there's any doubt that he killed my husband. That night when Earl had to stay in his office to work on the books, I think he was expecting Mount Clemens.
But the police say Mount Clemens left for New York at 3 o'clock that afternoon by plane.
I don't think so. I think he drove to New York in that station wagon that was parked in the alley.
Zoe stood up to leave.
But they'll never prove anything now that he's gone.
As Quillerin rose, she extended a hand in a soft leather glove. She did it almost with gaiety.
I must hurry. I have an appointment at Penniman School. They're taking me on the faculty.
Zoe smiled radiantly and walked from the office with a light step. Quillerin watched her go and said to himself, She's free now and she's happy.
Who freed her?
Then he hated himself for his next thought. And if it was Butchie, I wonder if the plot was entirely Butchie's idea. For a while, professional suspicion argued with personal inclination. The latter said, Zoe is a lovely woman, incapable of such a heinous plot, and she sure knows how to wear clothes. To which professional suspicion replied, She's pretty eager to have her husband's murder blamed on the critic now that he's gone and can't defend himself. She keeps coming up with scraps of information, strictly afterthoughts, that make Mount Clemens look like a heel.
But she's so gentle and appealing and talented and intelligent, and that voice, like velvet.
She's a smart dame, all right. Two people stabbed and she gets the jackpot. It would be interesting to know how those maneuvers were engineered. Butchie may have done the dirty work, but she isn't bright enough to hatch the plot. Who gave her the key to the back door of the gallery? And who told Butchie to vandalize the female figure in order to throw suspicion on a cockeyed male? Zoe wasn't even interested in Butchie. She was just using her.
Yes, but Zoe's eyes. So deep and honest.
You can't trust a woman with eyes like that. Just stop and think what probably happened on the night of Mount Clemens' murder. Zoe phoned him to arrange a rendezvous, saying she'd drive into the deserted alley and sneak in the back way. That's probably the way she always did it. She'd blow the horn, and Mount Clemens would go out and unlock the patio gate. But the last time it happened, it wasn't Zoe standing there in the dark. It was Butchie, with a short, wide, sharp, pointed blade. But Zoe is such a lovely woman. And that gentle voice and those knees. Quillerin, you're a dope. Don't you remember how she got you out of the way on the night of Mount Clemens's murder by inviting you to dinner? That evening, Quillerin went home and sat down and said to Quillerin, "You fell for that helpless female act and let her make you a stooge. Remember how she sighed and bit her lip and stammered and called you so understanding? All the time she was building up her case with hints, alibis, painful revelations. And did you notice that nasty gleam in her eye today? It was the same savage look she put in that cat picture at the Lambeth Gallery. Artists always paint themselves. You found that out." Quillerin was plunged in the depths of his big armchair, pulling on a pipe that had burned out some minutes before. His silence weighted the atmosphere, and a shrill protest eventually came from Coco. "Sorry, old fellow," said Quillerin. "I'm not very sociable tonight." Then he sat up straight and asked himself, "What about that station wagon? Did Mount Clemens drive it to New York? And whose was it?" Coco spoke again, this time from the hallway. His conversation was a melodic succession of cat sounds that had a certain allure. Quillerin walked out to the hall and found Coco frolicking on the staircase. The cat's slender legs and tiny feet, looking like long-stemmed musical notes, were playing tunes up and down the red-carpeted stairs. When he saw Quillerin, he raced to the top of the flight and looked down with an engaging follow-me invitation in his stance and the tilt of his ears. Quillerin suddenly felt indulgent toward this friendly little creature who knew when companionship was needed. Coco could be more entertaining than a floor show and at times better than a tranquilizer. He gave much and demanded little. Quillerin said, "Want to visit your old stamping ground?" He followed Coco and unlocked the critic's door with the key he carried. Trilling with delight, the cat walked in and explored the apartment, savoring every corner. "Have a good smell, Coco. That woman from Milwaukee will be coming soon, and she'll sell the place and take you home with her, and then you'll have to live on beer and pretzels." Coco, as if he understood and wished to comment, paused in his tour and sat down on his spine for a brief but significant wash-up of his nether parts. "I gather you'd rather live with me." The cat ambled toward the kitchen, sprang to his old post on the refrigerator, found it cushionless, complained, and jumped down again. Hopefully he reconnoitered the corner where his dinner plate and water bowl used to be. Nothing there. He hopped lightly to the stove, where the burners tantalized him with whiffs of last week's boiled-over broth. From there he stepped daintily to the butcher's block, redolent with memories of roasts and cutlets and poultry. Then he nuzzled the knife rack and dislodged one blade from the magnetic bar. "Careful," said Quillerin. "You could cut off a toe." He put the knife back on the magnet. As he lined it up with the other three blades, his mustache flagged him, and Quillerin had a sudden urge to go down to the patio. He went to the broom closet for the flashlight and wondered why Mount Clemens had gone down the fire escape without it. The steps were dangerous, with narrow treads partly iced. Had the critic thought he was going down to meet Zoe? Had he thrown his tweed coat over his shoulders and gone down without a flashlight? Had he taken a knife instead? The fifth knife that belonged on the magnetic rack. Mount Clemens had left his prosthetic hand upstairs. A man so vain would have worn it to meet his paramour, but he wouldn't need it to kill her. Quillerin turned up the collar of his corduroy jacket and stepped carefully down the fire escape, accompanied by a curious but unenthusiastic cat. The night was cold. The alley kept its after-hours silence. The newsman wanted to see how the patio gate opened, in what direction the shadows fell, how visible an arriving visitor would be in the darkness. He examined the solid plank gate with its heavy Spanish lock and strap hinges. Mount Clemens would have remained partly hidden behind the gate as he opened it. One swift movement by the visitor would have pinned him to the wall. Somehow Mount Clemens had failed to take his intended victim by surprise. Somehow the murderer had managed to get the jump on him. While Quillerin mused and ran the flashlight over the weathered bricks of the patio, Coco discovered a dark stain on the brick floor and sniffed it intently. Quillerin grabbed him roughly about the middle. "Coco, don't be disgusting." He went back up the fire escape, carrying the cat, who writhed and squalled as if he were being tortured. In Mount Clemens's kitchen, Coco sat down in the middle of the floor and had a pedicure. His brief walk in the unclean outdoors had soiled his toes, his claws, the pads of his dainty feet. Spreading the brown toes like petals of a flower, he darted his pink tongue in and out, washing, brushing, combing, and deodorizing with one efficient implement. Suddenly the cat paused in the middle of a lick. His tongue extended and his toes spread in midair. A faint rumble came from his throat and he unfolded to standing position, tense with subdued excitement. Then, deliberately, he walked to the tapestry in the long hall and pawed the corner. "There's nothing down in that old kitchen except dust," said Quillerin, and then his mustache tingled, and he had a singular feeling that the cat knew more than he himself did. He picked up the flashlight, rolled up the corner of the tapestry, unbolted the door, and went down the narrow service stairs. Coco was waiting at the bottom, making no sound, but when Quillerin picked him up, he felt the cat's body vibrating, and he felt tension in every muscle. Quillerin opened the door and let it swing into the old kitchen, quickly flashing his light around the entire room. There was nothing there to warrant Coco's restlessness. Quillerin trained the flashlight on the easel, the littered table, the canvases stacked against the walls. And then, with a disturbing sensation on his upper lip, he realized there were fewer canvases than he had seen the night before. The easel was empty, and the robot propped on the sink was gone. Momentarily off his guard, he lost his hold on Coco, and the cat jumped to the floor. Quillerin swung around and flashed the light into the dining room. It was empty as before. In the kitchen, Coco was stalking something, with stealth in every line of his body. He jumped first to the sink, teetered on the edge while he scanned the area, then noiselessly down to a chair, then up to the table. As he ran his nose over the clutter on the tabletop, his mouth opened, his whiskers flared, and he showed his teeth, while with one paw he scraped the table around the palette knife. Quillerin stood in the middle of the room and tried to assemble his thoughts. Something was happening here that made no sense. Who had been in this kitchen? Who had removed the paintings and why? The two pictures of robots had disappeared. What else had been taken? Quillerin placed the flashlight on a tiled counter so that the light fell on the few remaining canvases in the room, and he turned one around. It was a scrano. A blaze of orange and yellow triangles, the canvas was painted in the Italian artist's smooth, slick style, and yet it had a feeling of depth that made Quillerin reach out to touch the surface. Down in the corner was the famous signature, daubed in block letters. Quillerin set it aside and turned another painting around to face the room. Again, triangles. These were green on blue. Behind this canvas there were more, gray on brown on black, white on cream. Proportions and arrangements varied, but the triangles were all pure scrano. A throaty murmur from Coco attracted Quillerin's attention. The cat was sniffing the orange triangles on the yellow background. Quillerin wondered what it was worth, 10,000, 20,000? Perhaps even more, now that scrano would paint no more. Had Mount Clemens been cornering the market? Or were these forgeries? And in either case, who was stealing them? Coco's nose covered the surface of the painting in great detail, as if he were experiencing the texture of the canvas visible under the pigment. When he came to the signature, his neck was stretched, and he tilted his head first to one side and then to the other as he strained to get close to the letters. His nose moved from right to left, first tracing the O, then studying the N, moving on to the A, sniffing the R with gusto as if it were something special, then on to the C, and finally lingering over the S. "Remarkable," said Quillerin. "Remarkable." He hardly heard the turning of a key in the back door, but Coco heard it. The cat vanished. Quillerin froze as the door slowly opened. The figure that stood in the doorway made no move. In the half-light, Quillerin saw square shoulders, heavy sweater,
square jaw, high square brow. "Narks," said Quillerin. The man came to life. He sidled into the room, reaching for the table. His eyes were on Quillerin. With a lunge, he seized the palette knife and rushed forward. Suddenly, shrieks, snarls. The room was full of flying things, swooping down, across, back, up, over. The man ducked. The hurtling bodies were quicker than the eye. They screamed like harpies. They flew down, under, up, across. Something hit him in the arm. He faltered. In that half moment, Quillerin pounced on the flashlight and swung it with all his force. Narks staggered back, went down. There was a sharp, rending crack as his head struck the tiled counter. He slumped slowly to the floor. Chapter 16. It was 5:30 at the press club, and Quillerin was relating the story for the 100th time. All day Monday, the personnel of the Daily Fluxion had been filing past his desk to hear the details firsthand. At the press club bar, Odd Bunsen said, "I wish I'd been there with my camera. I can picture our hero phoning the police with one hand and holding up his pants with the other." "Well, I had to tie Narks with my belt," Quillerin explained. "When his head hit the tile counter, he was out cold, but I was afraid he'd come around while I was phoning the police. I'd already tied his wrists with my necktie, my good Scotch tie, and the only thing I had for his ankles was my belt." "How did you know it was Narks?" "When I saw that square face and those square shoulders, I thought of those pictures of robots, and I knew this man must be the artist. Painters, I've been told, always put some quality of themselves on canvas, whether they paint kids or cats or sailboats. But Coco was the one who made it all clear. When he read Scrano's signature, backwards." Arch said, "How does it feel to be playing Dr. Watson to a cat?" Odd said, "What about the signature? That's something I missed?" "Coco read the signature on this painting," Quillerin explained, "and he spelled it out backwards. He always reads backwards."
"Oh, naturally. It's an old Siamese custom."
"That's when I realized that Scrano, the painter of the triangles, was also O. Narks, the painter of the robots. Their painted surfaces had the same slick metallic effect. A few minutes later, the robot himself walked into the house and came at me with a palette knife. He would have got me, too, if Coco hadn't come to the rescue."
"Sounds as if that cat's in line for a civilian citation. What did he do?"
"He went berserk. And one Siamese flying around in a panic looks and sounds like a pack of wildcats. Zoom, screech, wham. I thought there were six animals in that room, and that fellow Narks was one bewildered guy."
"So, Scrano is a fake," said Arch.
"Yep. There's no Italian recluse hiding out in the Umbrian hills," said Quillerin. "There's only Oscar Narks, manufacturing triangle pictures for Mount Clemens to plug in his column and sell in his art gallery."
"Funny why he wouldn't use his own name," said Odd.
Then Arch said, "But Mount Clemens's last column said there wouldn't be any more stuff from Scrano." "I think Mount Clemens was planning to eliminate Oscar Narks," said Quillerin. "Maybe Narks knew too much. I suspect our critic was not on that 3 o'clock plane the day of Lambert's murder. I suspect he had an accomplice who used the plane ticket and entered Mount Clemens's name on the passenger list. And I'll bet that accomplice was Narks."
"And then Mount Clemens took a later flight," said Arch.
"Or drove to New York," said Quillerin, "in the mysterious station wagon that was parked behind the gallery in the late afternoon. Zoe Lambreth heard her husband talking about it on the phone."
Odd Bunsen said, "Mount Clemens was crazy to let another guy in on the plot. If you're going to commit murder, go it alone, I always say."
"Mount Clemens wasn't stupid," said Quillerin. "He probably had a clever alibi figured out, but something went wrong." Arch, who had been hearing fragments of Quillerin's story all day, said, "What makes you so sure Mount Clemens was going to kill somebody when he went down to his backyard?" "Three reasons." Quillerin was enjoying himself. He was speaking with authority and making large gestures. "First, Mount Clemens went down to the patio to meet someone, and yet this vain man left his prosthetic hand upstairs. He wasn't going to greet a guest, so he didn't need it. Second, he did not take the flashlight, although the steps were icy and treacherous. Third, I suspect he took a kitchen knife instead. There's one missing."
Quillerin's audience was hanging on every word. Apparently, he went on, Mount Clemens failed to take Narx by surprise. Unless he could surprise him and sink the knife in his back as Narx came through the gate, there was a good chance that the younger man would overpower the critic. Narx is a powerful-looking adversary, and it was one hand against two. How do you know Mount Clemens went downstairs to meet someone? He had on his lounging coat. He probably had his topcoat over his shoulders while waiting for Narx, then threw it off to get ready for action. Narx would unlock the gate, which swings into the patio, and Mount Clemens would be waiting behind it, ready to knife him in the back. He probably planned to deposit the body in the alley where the murder would be blamed on a tramp. It's that kind of neighborhood.
If Narx is as formidable as you say, said Arch, how did that fool think he could pull off the job with one hand?
Vanity. Everything Mount Clemens did, he did superbly. It gave him an impossible conceit. And I think I know why he failed this time. It's only a guess, but here's how I figure it. When Narx was unlocking that patio gate, he was alerted to Mount Clemens's presence.
How?
He smelled that lime peel scent that Mount Clemens always wore.
Crazy, said Odd Bunsen.
Arch said, Narx might have gotten away with murder if he hadn't come back for those paintings.
Two murders, said Quillerin, if it hadn't been for Coco.
Anybody want another drink?
Arch said.
Bruno, let's have two more martinis and a tomato juice. Make it three martinis. Here comes Lodge Kendall.
Skip the tomato juice, said Quillerin. I've got to leave in a couple of minutes. Kendall was hurrying with news.
Just came from headquarters, he said. Narx is finally able to make a statement and the police have his story. It's just the way Quill said. Narx painted the Scrano pictures. Every time he came to town, he camped out in Mount Clemens's vacant apartment, but mostly he worked in New York. He brought the stuff here by station wagon, posing as Scrano's New York agent.
Did he mention the 3 o'clock plane flight?
Yes. He was the one who used Mount Clemens's ticket,
Odd said.
Then Mount Clemens, that hammerhead, let him in on the plot.
No. Narx was innocent at that stage of the game. You see, he had just come to town with the wagon, and Mount Clemens told him to fly right back to New York to meet a big buyer who was due in unexpectedly from Montreal. Mount Clemens said he had just arranged this deal by phone, in Narx's name, the way he conducted all Scrano business. Narx understood he was to hustle back and meet the Canadian in New York at 5 o'clock and sell him a flock of Scrano paintings. It sounded logical enough to Narx. After all, he was front man for the operation. So Mount Clemens turned his own ticket over to Narx, drove with him to the airport, and saw him off on the 3 o'clock plane.
How come Mount Clemens's name was on the passenger list?
According to Narx, they barely made it to the airport by flight time, and Mount Clemens said, don't bother to change the name on the ticket, just go directly to the gate and check in. He said he had decided to drive. He claimed he would start out immediately in Narx's station wagon, stop in Pittsburgh overnight, and arrive in New York Thursday morning.
Quillerin said, I can guess what went wrong.
Well, said Kendall, the sucker from Montreal was nuts about those triangles. He wanted all he could get, so Narx phoned Earl Lambert and asked him to air freight some of the older stock that hadn't sold.
That's the phone call Zoe overheard.
Lambert said he'd send them by wagon, but Narx told him that Mount Clemens and the station wagon were already halfway to Pittsburgh. Lambert said no, the car was still there, parked in the alley behind the gallery.
So Narx smelled a rat.
Not until he heard the news of Lambert's murder and realized Mount Clemens had lied. Then he decided to capitalize on it. He hated Mount Clemens anyway. He felt like a flunky, a robot, always carrying out the great man's orders. So he decided to hit him for a bigger cut of the dough that Mount Clemens was raking in from Scrano sales.
Odd said, Narx was dumb to think he could blackmail a sharp operator like Monty.
So Mount Clemens laid for him in the patio, said Kendall, but Narx got the jump and grabbed the knife.
Did he say why he returned to the scene?
Mostly to collect some paintings that had his own signature on them. He was afraid the police might start checking. But he also took some Scrano pictures and was going back for more when he ran into Quill and that cat.
Arch said, What will happen to the value of Scrano pictures when this story breaks? A lot of investors are going to be jumping out of high windows.
Well, I'll tell you something, said Quillerin. I've looked at a lot of art in the last few weeks, and if I had some dough to squander, I think I'd buy some nice gray and white triangles by Scrano.
Man, you're lost, said Odd.
I forgot to tell you, said Kendall. Those triangle pictures were a collaboration.
Narks says he painted them, but Mount Clemens designed them.
Very clever, said Quillerin. Mount Clemens had lost a hand and couldn't paint. Narks had a great technique, but no creative imagination. Pretty slick.
I'll bet a lot of artists have ghost painters, said Odd.
Come on, have another tomato juice, Arch invited. Live it up.
No thanks, said Quillerin. I'm having dinner with Zoe Lambreth, and I've got to go home and change my shirt.
Before you go, said Odd, maybe I should explain about that lady welder and why I didn't get any pics last week.
No rush, said Quillerin.
I went to the school, but she wasn't there. She was home with a couple of sore flippers.
What happened?
Remember that guy that fell and killed himself? The Bolton dame tried to save him. He fell against her hands and sprained her wrists. But she'll be back this week, and I'll get your shots.
Make them good, Quillerin said. Flatter the gal if you can. When Quillerin arrived home to feed the cat, he found Coco sprawled on the living room carpet taking a bath.
Dressing for dinner, said Quillerin.
The pink tongue darted over white breast, brown paws, and fawn flanks. Moistened pads were wiped over velvety brown ears. The lustrous brown tail was clutched between forepaws and groomed with painstaking care. Coco looked surprisingly like a cat and not the supernal creature who read minds, knew what was going to happen, smelled what he couldn't see, and sensed what he couldn't smell. Quillerin said,
They should have given you a headline, Coco. Cat sleuth sniffs out double murder clue.
You were right every time, and I was wrong every time. Nobody stole the gold dagger. Mount Clemens didn't take the 3 o'clock plane. Butchie didn't commit any crimes. Nina wasn't murdered. And Zoe didn't lie to me. Coco went on licking his tail.
But I still don't have all the answers. Why did you lead me to that closet upstairs? To get Mitty Mouse, or to help me find the Giraudo monkey?
Why did you call attention to the knife rack Friday night? Did you want me to know one was missing? Or were you just suggesting some chopped tenderloin? And why did you insist on going downstairs to that kitchen? Did you know Narks was coming? And how about the palette knife? Why were you trying to cover it up? Did you know what was going to happen? Coco went on licking his tail. And another thing. When Oscar Narks came at me with that blade, did you really panic? Were you just a scared cat, or were you trying to save my life?
Coco finished his tale and gazed at Quillerin with a faraway look, as if some divine answer was forming in his glossy brown head. Then he twisted his lithe body into a tortured shape, turned up his nose, crossed his eyes, and scratched his ear with one hind leg, and an expression of catly rapture.
The End. You've been listening to The Cat Who Could Read Backwards by Lillian Jackson Braun, narrated by George Guidel. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, the series continues with The Cat Who Ate Danish Modern, also narrated by George Guidel. You'll find a wide selection of titles in the Recorded Books catalog, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. So to order another Recorded Book, or for a copy of our latest listing, please call us using the toll-free number found on the back of the book. You can order by phone with any major credit card, or by writing to us or by faxing us. Don't forget to ask about easy 30-day rentals by mail. On our website, you can browse the catalog, hear about the latest releases, place orders, or tune in to narrator profiles and author interviews. So visit us there at www.recordedbooks.com. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.